Hello, and welcome to the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup Podcast. I'm Tom Bondurant, and this week we'll be talking about new comics from September 16th, 2009, and a couple from the week before. Action Comics number 881, Agents of Atlas number 11, Batman and Robin number 4, Batman Streets of Gotham number 4, Blackest Night number 3, The Brave and the Bold number 27, Captain America Reborn number 3, Green Arrow and Black Canary number 24, JSA vs. Cobra number 4, Marvel's Project number 2, Warlord number 6, and Wednesday Comics numbers 10 and 11. Let's begin with Green Arrow and Black Canary number 24, which was written by Andrew Kreisberg and penciled by Mike Norton. The first story was inked by Joe Rubinstein, and the second was inked by Bill Sienkiewicz. This issue focuses on a chase scene involving Black Canary and Cupid, who carjack what looks like a PT Cruiser convertible, not that that's important. Black Canary has broken Cupid out of jail so that they can track down Big Game, who apparently was caught in a conflagration with Green Arrow. So Black Canary and Cupid have many Star City police cruisers on their tail. Big Game, of course, shows up, and they fight him. And at the very end, the first story, Speedy, who is Green Arrow's ostensible sidekick, as opposed to Black Canary, who's his life partner, Speedy shows up and captures Big Game. And the second story focuses on how Speedy got back to Star City and ends on a cliffhanger involving the three superheroes' relationship, collective relationship. And for what it is, the lead story and the second story, for that matter, are executed fairly well on their own terms. Cupid is sort of typical Harley Quinn-esque, wisecracking, pain in the neck. You know she's a villain, but darn it, she's spunky and funny. And I did think that Norton's pencils were good throughout the issue. He has a nice sense of pace, and you know, he does a good car chase, and nice expression showing, you know, Black Canary's consternation and Cupid's can-do spirit, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, good heroic entrance for Speedy on the last page of the first story. And Kreisberg, you know, if this were my first issue of Green Arrow and Black Canary, I might be inclined to pick up the next issue. But I can't, you know, maybe I keep saying I'll have to go back and read Kreisberg's run. I haven't had a chance to do that. Maybe it'll seem better all collected, but it seems like this particular plot has been going on for, well, it has been going on ever since Kreisberg has been on the book, and that's, gosh, it seems like a long time. So I think this is a good enough stopping point for me. I'm going to, you know, see if I can live without Green Arrow and Black Canary for a while. Maybe I will. Yes, go back and read the whole Kreisberg run and see how it all holds together. And then, you know, pick up the back issues if the mood strikes and the budget will allow. So, you know, it's kind of too little too late for me and this book. I like Mike Norton. Thank goodness he's still doing the Blue Beetle co-feature. And here's hoping that the book improves on a second look. Next up is The Brave and the Bold number 27, and it is the long-awaited debut of writer J. Michael Straczynski doing classic DC characters teamed up with obscure DC characters. And this issue is Batman, the classic Bruce Wayne Batman, teamed up with Dial H for Hero, or Dial H for H-E-R-O, I should say. Robbie Reed is this kid who finds this magic, for all intents and purposes, H-Dial, which has a number of letters and sort of an old telephone dial, you know, ask your grandparents, kids, configuration. And if he dials HERO, then he turns into a randomly generated supervillain. I should say randomly generated superhero. And in the olden days of the 60s, when dial H for hero was concocted, the gimmick was that readers would send in their own superheroes, and if they were lucky, they would be featured as one of the super people that Robbie turned into. And you could also dial V for villain, and it would turn you into supervillain. But Robbie never did that because he was, you know, a good kid. Anyway, most of this issue focuses on Robbie and what happens when he decides to stop a gang from terrorizing Gotham City. Speaking of Gotham itself, I thought Straczynski did a good job of conveying sort of the tourist's view of Gotham. And he did a good job, I think, with Batman's closing speech, which is meant to tie together the events of the issue and sort of put them in context. And the said events have, I don't know if they're controversial across the blogosphere because I haven't really looked, but they don't leave Robbie in the best light. And I thought, given the title of the story, Death of a Hero, and knowing that they're not going to kill Batman, knowing that they're not going to kill Robbie, and seeing who else comes into the story, you have a pretty good idea one of these things is not like the others. And so I found the story to be kind of predictable, and then Straczynski tries to sort of temper that at the end by introducing a twist involving Robbie's role in the events, and then, like I say, using Batman to wrap everything up again and put a good face on it. And for what it's worth, if you come into this story with the image of, if Batman's speech at the end causes you to remember that he's seen sidekicks die and be driven into hiding, as Stephanie Brown was, and otherwise, you know, put in mortal danger. And if you realize that Batman has some guilt over that, and especially over his own childhood, then I think the speech will mean more to you. But that kind of assumes a level of knowledge about Batman that I'm not sure that every reader has. And for me, even though I have that knowledge, the story still came across as kind of, not really manipulative, but you could tell that someone had written it. Because first you have this, oh no, Batman's going to come down hard on Robbie because of what he did. And then Batman, the story basically sets up Batman to be the bad guy, emotionally speaking. Well, first it sets up Robbie to be the bad guy, and then it sets up Batman to be the bad guy because he's going to pile on Robbie. And then when he doesn't, it's like, well, that's a nice surprise, but Robbie shouldn't have been in that situation to begin with. That's a long way of saying that this story, I didn't like the story overall because it did not hew to the sort of innocent image that I have of Dial H for Hero, and I recognize that as an unrealistic expectation for me to bring to a story. But at the same time, clearly there are an infinite number of things you can do with a concept like Dial H for Hero, and there are, by the same token, a number of other characters that you probably could have done this same story with that would have been more appropriate than Robbie Reed. So that's a long way of saying, as I said in the Robot 6's What Are You Reading feature, why didn't Batman just dial the H dial, and we could have had some fun with that. I do like the art. I like Jesus Saiz. I've liked him since his Checkmate days, and I think he's going to be a good artist for Brave and the Bold. And of course, Straczynski is going to have other characters besides the relatively obscure ones in this. I think there's a Flash Blackhawk team up coming next issue, so we'll see what he does with that. Warlord number 6 was written by Mike Grell, penciled by Chad Harden, and inked by Walden Wong and Wayne Foscher, and it wraps up the first story arc. It is a big blowout action issue featuring, among other things, Travis Morgan attacking the bad guy aboard said bad guy's dirigible of doom. You know, there's a lot of running around, swordplay, fighting, shooting, women in fur bikinis because, you know, it's a fantasy book and you have to have odd material for your bikini. And it's pretty typical for that kind of thing. It's not going to be a classic of Western literature by any stretch. But the burden, I suppose, falls on Harden to convey the reader successfully through all these action sequences. And by and large, I think he does that. There were a few scenes that I had to go back and sort of scan the panels for the important information. So I give Harden, you know, 3 out of 5 stars, just pulling something off the top of my head, for his storytelling ability. I suppose some of that, though, falls on the inkers, Wong and Foscher, for not doing their part to highlight what's important where. But, you know, all things considered, decent issue. I'm not sure I'm going to stay with this book. I want to support it on principle because I like DC having a more diverse main line of comic books. But I think Grell is, I can't remember if Grell is going to write in pencil next issue, but I know that's coming up, so I'll probably stick with it through that at least. JSA vs. Cobra number 4 was written by Eric Troutman, penciled by Don Kramer, and inked by Michael Babinski. It finally finds the JSA, and Mr. Terrific specifically, getting a leg up on Cobra's plans. This issue involves Cobra hijacking super tankers and crashing them into ports, which is an excellent terrorist-type supervillain activity. I don't mean to sound gleefully morbid about that, but, I mean, if you're reading a comic book about superpowered terrorists, that's the kind of scary stuff you want to see superheroes stop. And, not to spoil anything, but eventually they do stop it. This issue brings in Johnny Thunder and Thunderbolt, uses, as always, Mr. Terrific to good effect, and finds Cobra exploiting the magical ends of the DC Universe fairly successfully as well. And it also, I was pleasantly surprised, I will not spoil this for anybody, but I was pleasantly surprised to see perhaps one of the, something that can be considered one of the cornerstones of Checkmate, making another appearance in this issue. I was not expecting to see that again, and it's kind of like, you know, what you see on the monitor screens towards the end of Star Wars Episode 2. And it's got a kind of that presentation here. So that was nice. As I say, this is a very good superhero versus supervillain self-contained storyline. I don't read the main Justice Society book, and I'm enjoying the heck out of this. And I continue to enjoy the Kramer-Babinski team, especially as colored by Art Lyon. They work very well together, and I look forward to their next collaboration. I have to remind myself that Action Comics number 881 isn't the newest issue of Supergirl, because it features Supergirl prominently. It's written or co-written by Sterling Gates, who writes Supergirl's own title, and, well, there is no third thing. But it's a very good, I thought, installment in the continuing saga of the new Krypton Fallout. It is co-written, as I say, by Greg Rucka and Sterling Gates, and it is drawn by Pere Perez. One of the things that I enjoyed particularly about this issue is a little sequence toward the end of the lead story where Supergirl is reading the Riot Act to Flamebird, who is her old friend, and Perez does a neat trick of, in one panel, Supergirl is pointing toward the camera, as it were, toward the reader, and, you know, with this very accusatory expression on her face, and then Flamebird's expression is almost, I'm laughing because I'm looking at it, and it's funny, but it's well done as well. Flamebird has, you know, one eye half closed almost, her lips starting to curl. She looks like Elvis, to tell you the truth, or Billy Idol one. She's kind of shoving Nightwing out of the way, and you can see she is coming towards the camera. You know, the perspective is reversed, so she's coming towards Supergirl, and you know what the next panel is going to be. Sure enough, you turn the page, and choom, there comes Supergirl flying out of a building head first, because Flamebird's just laid one on her, and not in a good way. And anyway, it all comes at the end of a sequence where we see Supergirl actually on top of things for once. Supergirl, it turns out, has hidden hideaways all over the world, not unlike Batman, and indeed Supergirl explains that's where she got the idea. But again, most of the issue is Supergirl trying to bring down Nightwing and Flamebird because she thinks they've turned against the Earth. Nightwing and Flamebird, of course, have not. It's all a big conspiracy to turn the Earth against the Kryptonians. And naturally, it ends on a cliffhanger at the foot of the Eiffel Tower. So, not sure where this is continued next. Probably in the next Superman title that comes out. Anyway, I enjoyed it. I continue to enjoy... next week in Supergirl number 45. I continue to enjoy the new Krypton storyline. And let's talk about the co-feature, which is Captain Atom, written by Rucka and James Robinson and drawn by Cafu. In it, we learn, of course, that Captain Atom has been sort of brainwashed or had his wits scrambled so that he will serve the military that much more freely, as it were. And so there's some fighting and zapping and things like that. That all comes off decently. Captain Atom is one of these tricky characters because he's supposed to be extremely powerful, since he taps into the quantum field that gets to the fundamental nature of all things. And so for the army or anybody to mind control him is going to be tricky for a writer to convince us about. So we'll see how that comes across. I'm glad that they're getting back to Cap's sort of military paranoia roots that go back to his mid-80s Reagan-era relaunch. But so far, this storyline hadn't really gotten me that excited. Anyway, moving on. Don't have much to say about Wednesday Comics 10 and 11. I'll probably have more to say next week, when the whole thing wraps up and I can put some periods to the various stories. I will say that it took me this long, you know, pretty much up until the next to last issue, to realize that what was bothering me about the Dead Man feature is that Dead Man, kind of like Dial H for Hero, Dead Man is sort of forced out of his usual shtick of inhabiting different people's bodies, and instead it's just kind of reduced to fighting demons in hell, which isn't what I expect out of a Dead Man strip, for whatever that's worth. And the Teen Titans strip sort of adds an unnecessary layer of plot to what was already a pretty thin excuse for a storyline. And the Wonder Woman strip, I hate to say the more conventional it gets, the more I like it, but it does make me want to go back and look at the whole thing. I think it was written more for the collection than for the individual page, although I appreciate what Ben Caldwell was trying to do with the individual pages. So anyway, more to say on Wednesday Comics next time. Captain America Reborn was written by Ed Brubaker, penciled by Brian Hitch, and inked by Butch Geis. And I can sum up my feelings about this issue by saying I was glad to see Reed Richards show up. On some level, I'm always glad to see Reed show up because that means we're going to get some explanation and probably a signpost as to where the plot may well go. But it was nice to see Reed and Namor visiting Steve Rogers' last resting place in the Arctic where he was found. I didn't know that that's where they'd left him. Maybe that was in one of the many Death of Captain America books that I did not read. But amongst all of the Billy Pilgrim unstuck in time moments that Steve also endures this issue, the plot moves forward. Sharon Carter visits the Avengers Mansion and goes through the Captain America trophy room, which is a nice touch. Bucky is broken out of the Red Skull's custody by the Falcon. Bucky gets to administer a nice beat down on one of his tormentors, which, you know, always good to see in these kinds of stories. And everybody looks to be headed towards Dr. Doom's time machine, literally and figuratively. This issue also features a flashback to the Kree-Skrull War, which of course I just got done reading as part of my impromptu summer reading program. So I appreciated Hitch and Geis's attempts to throw in a very Neil Adams-esque Thor, and otherwise recreate the feel of those issues. I think this series is a good blend of Cap's greatest hits and a sort of perfunctory let's get Cap back plot. It does not really, as much as it owes to the regular run of Captain America, things like, you know, including Reed Richards and Namor. Well, Namor's shown up in Captain, including Reed Richards especially. And things like the Cap Trophy Room in Avengers Mansion and these flashbacks bring it into more of the superhero realm than the regular Captain America comic book is. And I kind of get the feeling that's why this is its own separate miniseries. So it can appeal more to the people who are more used to the gaudy Marvel Universe and not so much to the moody, we'll deal with Civil War on our own terms feel that you get from Brubaker's Captain America. But a good installment, nice evil last page shot of the Red Skull, and looking forward to next issue. In other Ed Brubaker news, the Marvels Project, which was drawn by Steve Epting, follows a few different subplots. There is the defection, I guess you would call it a defection. Nick Fury helps Professor Erskine escape to the Allies. We catch up some more with the original Human Torch as he decides to become a superhero, and we follow the Angel, the masked mystery man who I did not recognize from issue number one, as he becomes a superhero and sort of, I won't say it's a Watchmen type moment, but he has unexpected connection with another very obscure, I'm sure, Marvel mystery man from the Golden Age, a fella named the Phantom Bullet, which strikes me as one of the more unfortunate superhero names. Much like on Mad Men last night, you don't want your hotel ad campaign to make people think of mice and hotels. You don't want your superhero name focusing on the ammunition that might well kill you. And so that may be a spoiler as to Phantom Bullet's fate, but anyway, kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy there. I enjoyed this issue. Again, I'm no Marvel scholar, so I don't know how much of this Brubaker is just piecing together from stuff that already exists and how much he is creating out of whole cloth, but it is an entertaining narrative. I like the way that, again, I didn't know anything about the Angel or the Phantom Bullet before reading issue number one, and I really liked the way that Brubaker and Epting pulled off the reveal at the end of this issue. And, of course, I'm familiar with the original Human Torch from various sources, and naturally everybody recognizes Professor Erskine as the creator of the Super Soldier formula, which created Captain America. So, good all around. But anyway, looking forward to next issue. Agents of Atlas number 11 was written by Jeff Parker and drawn by Dan Panosian and Gabriel Hardman. It is the last issue of the series, from what I understand, and it naturally features the wrap-up of Terror of the Jade Claw, which finds M11, the Agents of Atlas heroic killer robot, squaring off against M21, which is the Jade Claw's villainous killer robot. It is an extended fight sequence between the two sides, not just the killer robots. And it's all, the best part of it, as others have mentioned, is that M11 gets a Muhammad Ali subroutine installed, so he takes out M21 with a lot of style. And the mechanics by which M21 is taken out are a little familiar. But things like, you know, the Atlas Foundation's resident dragon sort of striking a truce with the Great Wall's resident dragon, or I should say coming to a rapport with the other dragon. There's a flying car that's reminiscent of Jimmy Woo's S.H.I.E.L.D. days. Just your ordinary Agents of Atlas amount of panache that Parker puts into this book. It is a shame that it didn't sell better, but the feature will continue in Incredible Hercules and next month in X-Men versus Agents of Atlas. So who knows? Maybe it's one of these things that'll just be revived every few years, putter along for a year, and then get canceled for low sales. Unless, you know, it finds a new home or a patron at Disney, and in that case, who knows what can happen. But until then, next up is Batman Streets of Gotham number 4, written by Paul Dini, penciled by Dustin Nguyen, and inked by Derek Friedolfs. It is a one-off story about the Broker, who you may remember was introduced in Gotham City Sirens as a character who, well, he's a realtor. And he is a realtor, I should say, and he finds supervillains. He finds headquarters for supervillains, specifically in Gotham City. And this is sort of a history of Gotham City real estate, which is fun in its own right, as well as the secret origin of the Broker. And the plot involves the Broker's newest client, Mr. Zazz, whose gimmick is that he carves a notch into his body for every person he's killed. So, haha, he has notches, bloody notches, scars all over his body, and usually goes into battle in nothing but a Speedo. Thankfully, that's not the case here. but he does cause the broker to, he probably is, let's say he's probably one of the broker's most unsavory clients. This causes the broker to run afoul of Batman, and therein we get the insight into the broker's character. So I thought it was a well-constructed story. The broker, as I say, is one of these characters who I liked because he not only explains why there are so many, for example, abandoned amusement parks in Gotham City, but he is an original character that can fit into that kind of fantastic framework and not so much explain it as exploit it. I mean, some things don't need to be explained necessarily, but if you can invent a story or a character that plays off of these elements, you know, say an architect who designs buildings based around giant crossword puzzles, then that's something else. And not just have a character like that, but construct a good story around it. And this was a good story. The broker has his own scruples. He's a bad guy, of course, but he only goes so far. And here we see how far he is willing to go. And it is not entirely predictable from the moment that we meet him. So Dini and Nguyen and Friedolfs do their customary good work throughout the issue. I like Nguyen's approach to Batman and to Gotham City generally. I kind of wish that his Dick Grayson Batman were a little leaner. I suppose he is. I haven't really compared the two side by side, Dick and Bruce, but maybe that's just me. Anyway, the second feature in Streets of Gotham is Manhunter, written by Mark Andreyko and drawn by Jeremy Hahn. This is the Manhunter teaming up with Huntress, excuse me, after they captured Jane Doe, and Manhunter kind of working out her frustrations about the Jane Doe case with Huntress. And that's about it, really. I think it's set up for Manhunter going after bigger criminals like Two-Face and Black Mask, who make cameo appearances toward the end of the story. I liked Hahn's art. It was reminiscent of Georges Jeanneté, who was, I know he was the original artist on the co-feature, but I can't remember when Hahn came in, if it was last issue or if this is his first issue. But I like Nick Filardi's colors and sort of the, I don't know what you'd call the effect that he brings to it. It's almost, as I was saying last time, it's almost like a watercolor or a chalk color effect. But it's very nice, and it ties together the whatever differences there are in the art styles. So we'll see how Manhunter goes next issue. Continuing with the Batman books, it's Batman and Robin number 4, written by Grant Morrison, penciled by Philip Tan, and inked by Jonathan Glapion. This issue starts off three issues by Tan and Glapion involving the Red Hood and Scarlet. Scarlet clearly is the daughter of the fella who was disfigured by Professor Pig in the first arc, and the Red Hood is probably who you think he is, although I would be surprised if that's who it turns out to be, because that seems fairly obvious. Anyway, Tan tries very hard, I think, to approximate Frank Quitely's kinetic layouts, and I don't think he succeeds. This is a very, it's like if Quitely were crossed with Tony Daniel. There are some pages that really flow, but there are more that kind of don't. And things like the scene where Batman and Robin are in the customary crouched on the balcony next to the gargoyles pose. I had a hard time following that scene because, again, it just does not flow. Upon further inspection, maybe the three different long shots of Batman and Robin on the balcony are meant to convey the passage of time, but you sure don't get that from reading it through, you know, the first time. There's another scene earlier in the book where a card, a red sort of calling card, falls out of a bag of money, and Tan follows that with some inset panels as it sort of flutters down into Batman's outstretched hand. But again, that's a decent effect, but I had a hard time figuring out where the bag of money was. So it didn't really impress me all that much. Probably the thing, you know, that I was most glad to see was the return of the Wayne penthouse and the rooftop party seemed to me to be reminiscent of the kinds of shindigs that Bruce Wayne would throw when he had the old penthouse with the patio back in the 70s. And of course I enjoyed 70s Batman a whole lot, so I was glad to see that. But that doesn't speak very well for the rest of the issue. We'll see where Morrison goes with the Red Hood and Scarlet, but for now it's kind of the same old, you know, Batman doesn't go far enough, the Red Hood's willing to slaughter criminals kind of thing that we've seen more than once and probably executed better. And finally, it's Blackest Night number 3, written by Jeff Johns, penciled by Ivan Rice, and inked by Eau Claire Albert. This is probably the best issue of Blackest Night so far. For many, I'm sure that will be damning with faint praise, but I did appreciate the blend of exposition and action in this issue. I read it a couple of times, and on the second reading, I was a little, I won't say annoyed, but you could see that Johns had planted little bits of foreshadowing about the fate of one of the characters, and, well, that was a little annoying. But on the whole, I thought it did a good job of sort of laying out the stakes, explaining the problem. The Indigo Tribe basically shows up and lays some exposition on Green Lantern, the Flash, and the Atom, who, along with Firestorm, have holed up in the... Oh, and Mira, have holed up in the Justice League's basement after being attacked by the Black Lantern Justice League. So we learn what the Black Lanterns are made of, what their relationship to the rings is, and how to kill them, or how to stop them, I should say. But then the issue closes out with another Black Lantern attack, which, as I say, does not go well for one of our heroes yet again, and ends on another cliffhanger whereby we see even more Black Lanterns, this time of the supervillains that are in the JLA's morgue. I don't have much to say about the art other than I liked it as much as I usually liked Rice and Albert. There's a two-page spread of the leader of the Indigo Tribe as she lays out the exposition, which I thought, well, it's rotated 90 degrees, which I thought was appropriate. Makes you, you know, obviously it calls attention to the fact that there is exposition, but at the same time, it's a nice change from what might have otherwise been a rather boring two-page spread worth of exposition. And in terms of the story, I will say that the mechanics behind the Black Lanterns revealed in this issue throws a monkey wrench into my own personal theory about where the storyline was going. I had kind of thought that once the power levels hit 100%, then the people themselves would come back, and then there would be an opportunity later to sort of snap them out of the evil mind control that the Black Lanterns had put them under, so you could in effect use Blackest Night as a sort of batch resurrection of all of the characters who had been killed for stunt value over the past few years, as well as the characters who were killed for stunt value throughout this miniseries. But that may not happen now, which makes the many death scenes that we've seen so far, not just in this series but earlier, seem even more gratuitous. But there's still 5 issues to go, and we'll see what happens next issue when the power levels do hit 100%. And I don't know, maybe this will all turn out the way I've been hoping, but I probably shouldn't get my hopes up. So on that uncertain note, we'll bring this edition of the podcast to a close. Thanks as always for listening, and I will see you in a few days.